We get the hour underway by welcoming back to the program one of our favorite people to talk to. He has been a successful musician, singer, producer, manager, radio host, author of the wonderful book, The Beatles From A to Z, and of course hosts From Me to You on the Beatles channel on Sirius XM Radio. We're so happy to welcome back Peter Asher. Peter, thank you for being with us.
No, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me back. It's always good to come visit.
Well, you know, the times we've had you on, we have never talked about one aspect of your career, and that's your time as a child actor. And my gosh, you worked with some giants, Alistair Sim, John Mills, Boris Karloff.
Yes, it's true. I was very lucky. And you left out one that was actually kind of my favorite in a way, because the very first film I did, my father was played by a British actor called Jack Hawkins, you might remember.
Oh, yes.
Lawrence of Arabia and all those great movies. But more significant to me was my mother was played by a genuine, gigantic American film star at the time, Claudette Colbert. So I got to kiss Claudette Colbert very enthusiastically when I was 8 years old, which was fun.
Well, about that.
I knew she wasn't really my mother at the time.
So I wanted to focus today on your producing work, though. And when was it that you became interested? Were you there watching what was going on when your records with Gordon were being produced and put together?
Exactly. Actually, that's precisely the case. Indeed, the very first day I was ever in a recording studio, when Gordon and I first, you know, did our first session after we'd been signed by EMI Records, we were in, you know, EMI Studios, or Abbey Road, as they named it later on. And I was immediately enthralled by the idea. Once I understood what a producer could do, that you were able to have ideas about the arrangement and the structure and how the tune sounded and the sound of the individual instruments, the fact that you could hire musicians much better than myself and tell them what to do, I thought that was brilliant. And so I pretty much decided that very day that I wanted to be a record producer. It was unlike being a manager, but being a producer was actually a specific and defined ambition of mine.
And those Peter and Gordon records, I think, were very well produced. You listen to a song like I Go to Pieces, and man, it sounds so great today.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, I mean, I pretty soon started, you know, watching very closely what our producers did, and also, to be honest, interfering. You know, I wasn't officially a producer on those records, but I certainly was. I fell into the interfering artist category and you know, got involved in the arrangement and the sound and all that kind of thing.
Well, after you and Gordon disbanded, you became the head of the A&R department at the brand new Apple Records. One of the first signings was James Taylor. And am I right that James came to you because of your work with Danny Kortchmar? He had been in the King Bees, who had played behind you and Gordon.
Exactly. You have it dead right. The King Bees, you know, Gordon and I were assigned a backup band for different legs of our American tour. Usually we weren't lucky enough to have one band for the whole tour. You know, it'd be like, oh, here's your East Coast band. You know, you've got one day of rehearsal, get it together. And which wasn't that hard, because in those days, of course, people did very short sets, as you probably know. So you only had to learn, you know, six tunes or something. But Danny Kortchmar was indeed the guitar player in one of those bands that was assigned to us, the King Bees, and he and I hit it off and became great friends and remained friends, you know, even after the Peter and Gordon period was over. And then Danny was subsequently in a band called The Flying Machine with his childhood friend, James Taylor. And they'd known each other since they were about 10 years old on Martha's Vineyard and so on. So that they were in a band together called The Flying Machine. That band broke up in New York. And James decided to leave for London. He thought he had a girlfriend he could stay with in London. Turned out in the end he didn't, but he believed that he did. And Cooch, Danny Kortchmar, gave him my phone number. Just said, "Here's my friend Peter. You know, he's okay. Give him a call." He didn't know I got this new job. So James called me out of the blue, introduced himself as Cooch's friend. I invited him over. He played me some songs, and I went crazy and thought it was the best thing I'd heard forever, you know, and said, explained to him. I said, "Look, it's oddly enough, I've got this new job. I'm head of A&R for a new record label. You know, I can sign people. Would you like a record deal?" And he said, yes, please, I'd love one. And, and at that point, I then had to explain, of course, whose label it was. And I took him into the office a day or two later to meet the Beatles and sign up with Apple. So he was indeed the first signing.
And that first album, did you record that in 8-track?
Yes, we did. Also very clever of you. They, up till then, everything we'd done as artists had been at EMI, which was exclusively 4-track. We discovered later they actually did have an 8-track machine. They were busy running tests on it and everything. EMI are very formal, you know, and like the BBC, everything had to be tested and up to their standards and so on. But I knew that on James, that record of James's, which is a little bit complex, it's got all the complexity, of course, there's no barrier because the Beatles made Sgt. Pepper on 4-track, goodness knows. But I decided I really wanted 8-track, and so I went to the studio called Trident, where they had 8-track and did the album there. And actually, you know, as you may know, Paul McCartney came over for me and played a bass on one track of that album, on Carolina in My Mind. He played bass, and that was his first venture into the world of 8-track, and he thought it was cool, so he brought all the Beatles over to Trident, and that's when they recorded their first ever track on 8-track, which is the song I was there for most of the session, and that was Hey Jude.
Now, the line in James's song, "A Holy Host of Others Gathered Around Me Now," that if I know my history, that was being there in the studios with the Beatles watching him.
That's a reference to the Beatles, absolutely, yes.
The first album was not a big success, but you made the decision to follow James and leave Apple and go to America. What was it you saw in him that made you believe he was going to be a success?
Everything, really. I mean, if you think of, you know, if I zero in on any of the particular elements, you know, his singing was amazing. He had this beautiful, rich, kind of folky voice, but his phrasing wasn't folky at all. His phrasing was all derived from his admiration for Ray Charles and Sam Cooke, you know, and I found that combination brilliant. His guitar playing was extraordinary. He had the precision of a classical guitarist, you know, but with a sort of, again, a folk kind of consciousness to it all, but also playing chords that you'd never hear in a folk song, you know. He would put in these chords you'd learn off a Manhattan's record or something. And so, you know, all that added together. And then, of course, his songwriting, you know. When you hear songs, Something in the Way She Moves and Something's Wrong are among those songs, the songs that he played me that very first evening in my flat in London. So it's kind of what didn't I hear? Every aspect of James's music I found stunning. So I had no doubt when Apple started to fall apart that we should leave, and that's when we decided that I should become his manager because we didn't know who else we trusted to do it. And so we just kind of went, okay, you know, I can do this because I the one thing I figured out was, you know, watching Brian Epstein work. Was the you know, the most important aspect. It's kind of annoying when people say to me, well, what's the most important thing about being a great manager? And the answer, unfortunately, is a great client, you know. You know, I got to induct the first two managers into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and not surprisingly, that was Brian Epstein, who managed the Beatles, and Andrew Lou Goldham, who managed the Rolling Stones. So it's like, duh, you know, you want to be a great manager, get the Beatles, you know. It's so simple.
When you produced Sweet Baby James, which became his breakthrough album, what did you do? How did you set things up as a producer to get that intimate sound that brings out every richness in his voice?
There's various answers to that question. I think partly, you know, on the first album, the Apple album, as I say, it was a little bit complicated. I had quite a lot of instruments. I was very anxious to make people pay attention. I wanted to say, look, this isn't just another long-haired folky with an acoustic guitar. This is some remarkable music. So we put a string quartet here and some brass here and this and the other. And I think maybe in retrospect, I overdid that process. So by the time we got to Sweet Baby James, I knew I wanted to keep it very simple. I wanted to make sure James's guitar playing and his songwriting and his singing came through, you know, unimpeded and just framed the best way it could be. So I wanted to put together a little band to play with James and rehearse. And I found these musicians. I found a drummer called Russ Kunkel, who I thought was amazing.
And he had never recorded before until you brought him into the session. Is that right?
I think he'd done one session as a member of a band. I can't remember the name of the band, but they had done, you know, a day in the studio. But he certainly never recorded as a kind of backup guy. He wasn't a studio musician at all. But I'd heard him at a rehearsal of a guy called John Stewart.
Do
you remember John?
Absolutely.
Songwriter, used to be in the Kingston Trio.
Right, wrote Daydream Believer for the Monkees.
Exactly, that's the man. I went to his rehearsal and went crazy for the drummer, Russ, and asked Russ if he'd play on this record I was about to make. And he said yes. And we both, James and I, of course, wanted Danny Kortchmar, our mutual friend, to play guitar on the record. And then Cooch also introduced me to one of my great heroes, my songwriting heroes, Carole King. And I'd heard her demos of all those great songs she'd written back in the day, you know, that extraordinary list of gigantic hit songs. And I loved her piano playing. So when I met Carole, I said, look, I know you're a super big deal songwriter and everything, but would you consider working just, you know, as a studio cat, as it were, for a week on this project? And she came over to my house and met James, and I got them to sit down together at the piano and just play. And it fit perfectly, as I thought it would, and Carole agreed to play on James's record. So if you look at every track on Sweet Baby James, the piano is, in every case, the great Carole King. And that was it, really. Then that was the band, and so I just kept things very simple.
And you rehearsed that band at your house, right?
Yes. We would rehearse like two or three songs in the afternoon at my house, and then head over to Sunset Sound, which I had booked, I think, from 6 o'clock on each evening, and we'd record those same songs. The album was done in about a week.
Yeah, was it during those sessions that Carole was also recording Tapestry, and Joni Mitchell was working on her album, too, and people were sort of shuffling back and forth?
Not quite. That's the next one.
Oh, that Mudslide Slim?
Interestingly, yes. In other words, Carole played on Sweet Baby James. Then Carole was actually making Tapestry around the same time we were making Mudslide Slim, James's second album. And Joni was doing Blue around that same time.
We're talking with Peter Asher here on Downtown. An album that was a huge blockbuster for James was JT, and it showcased his ability not just to do his own songs, but do covers. But the biggest hit cover from that album, as I understand it, Handyman, was one of those fortunate accidents. You weren't planning to put that on the album. That was just you catching something and hearing them playing around in studio and realizing you had some magic there.
That's right. James was a little skeptical about the idea of doing, you know, an oldie again. You know, he had a hit with How Sweet It Is. You know, and of course, You've Got a Friend wasn't an oldie, but it wasn't James's own song. But Danny Kortchmar actually started playing the guitar part from Handyman very slowly. And James, you know, just on a whim, we were on a break in the sessions, and James picked up his guitar and joined in and sang it that way. And there was something about the song being slowed down and done. There was just the two of them doing it with acoustic guitars. And that's pretty much the way I cut it, was the two acoustic guitars. Russ played congas, I think, on the basic track. And there was something about that song, you know, I'm your handyman. You know, it just made it a little more obvious what the song was really about. You know, that the handyman in this instance wasn't volunteering to put up some shelves.
You would go on to have a great success, a tremendous run of albums with Linda Ronstadt. She was having some management trouble when you came into her world, I believe.
Well, yes, a bit. You know, she was with this guy called Herbie Cohen, and he was a clever guy and a remarkable guy and highly entertaining, as I recall. But it was all a little bit shady. And at one point, the band that was with the Stone Ponies, they were flying to some gig somewhere. I forget the details. And when they landed, they were all arrested by the FBI because they were flying on stolen air tickets that the manager had provided. that was back in the day when if you got hold of those blanks, you could write in your own ticket, you know. So she ended up parting company with Herbie Cohen, and then I took over.
And that had to be tough work. I think I read a conversation somewhere along the way when you saw her the first time with this absolutely beautiful woman with an amazing voice. It's not hard to work with someone like that.
Not at all. No, and she also turned out to be, of course, one of the smartest women I've ever met, and remains a dear friend and someone I so much admire. She's quite extraordinary, a woman of great intellect.
You've said this before, and I think it was around the time of her Hall of Fame induction, that people, being the way they are, want to give you all of the credit for song selection, because she covered such a wide variety of songs, particularly on the first really big album, Heart Like a Wheel. But you've been very generous in pointing out that a lot of that was Linda, who had a great ear for what would work well.
Absolutely, yes. That's not generosity on my part, it's accuracy. She's a brilliant chooser of songs. Indeed, there are so many fantastic songwriters like J.D. Souther or the McGarrigle Sisters or others like Judy Sill, all kinds of people that, you know, that Linda turned me on to in terms of great songs. And so, yes, she chose many songs. In general, as a rough guide, if it's an up-tempo rock and roll song, there's a chance that it might have been my idea. If Linda given to her own devices, we tend to do all slow songs, which is not a bad thing, but she always used to prefer the ballady kind of songs. I think probably her favorite records are the ones we did with the ones with Nelson Riddle doing those beautiful classic American ballads with a big orchestra. You know, she loved that. But of course, she sang those brilliantly, but she also sang the hell out of amazing rock and roll tunes.
Yeah, well, it was
like Tumbling Dice.
Your idea to bring her You're No Good, I believe.
Well, actually, we both knew that song. She knew the song already, and so did I. Interestingly, I first heard it in England as the Swinging Blue Jeans version, which I don't think really ever did much in America, but in England that was a big hit, and rather than the Betty Everett one, which was the one that was a hit here. But Linda and I both liked that song. That was a joint choice. But then what we did do is work out a cool arrangement with the assistance of Andrew Gold, a remarkable musician who helped me with that whole guitar section of the song very much. And that's Linda and I worked out that whole arrangement, you know, which I think helped account for the success of the record, that and just how well she sang it.
And there are so many great songs on Heart Like a Wheel. One that often gets overlooked to me is an absolute killer version of a song that was a big R&B hit for James Carr, Dark Side of the Street.
Yeah. That's right. I was reading about that just today. Somebody was talking about that. That was a great song, and Linda sang it brilliantly. It is a great song.
Now, at the time, I was working in radio, and I was very excited when Mad Love came out. I loved the songs. I loved the interpretation, the arrangement. I thought it was a dynamite album. I wasn't aware that there were people, I guess, in the punk rock world who maybe thought that you were appropriating that sound.
They did, yeah, and they're not wrong, you know, in the sense that, yes, we just heard that kind of music and loved the energy and heard some of those songs, you know, like the Elvis Costello songs we did, and these are just when, Linda said, I want to sing these songs, they are great songs, you know, and she did sing them. But we didn't feel as if we were stealing anything, no, I mean, which is what, of course, appropriate implies, but she just loved the songs, and I certainly was inspired by the energy of some of those records I heard, and it still applied, you know, what I like to do, which is making. I do tend to, you know, I didn't go all the way into with the punk sensibility, in the sense that I do tend to like records that are sort of sound good and are in tune and neat and tidy. So in that sense, I can fully understand why someone with a full-on punk approach would kind of go, this is wrong. but I get it, you know. And it's funny because Elvis Costello at the time kind of denounced our versions, and you know, but he's since become a great friend of mine and someone I so much admire, and has admitted that he was completely wrong.
Everybody
at the time, he was extremely grateful for the
royalty
check he got from Melinda's record company.
Everybody in recent years has recorded from the Great American Songbook, but really it was Linda that did it first with those Nelson Riddle collaborations. Were you on board right away, or did it take some persuasion?
I was on board in the sense that I knew it was what Linda wanted, and I knew her appreciation of Nelson and his work was total and sincere, and that she really wanted to sing those songs. I didn't think it would be successful. I didn't think it would be certainly not as successful as it was. So the record company was going, this is a disaster, you know, she'll never sell a fraction of what her rock and roll records sell. And my position on that was, you might be right, but we're going to do it anyway because Linda's earned the right to do what she wants, and I know that she'll do it incredibly well. I will throw myself into this wholeheartedly and determinedly and make the best record we possibly can. So I was on board in that sense. Was I honestly a believer that it was going to sell three times as many as the rock and roll album that had preceded it, or that it was going to be number one for weeks and all the things that happened? No, I didn't know that. And I don't know if Linda did either. But Linda's compelled by what she could, you know, what she'll tell you is that she would hear songs or know songs or love songs from childhood or whatever, and she would put them in these songs I have to sing category. She not like I want to sing or I'd like to sing or please can I sing, but these are songs I have to sing. I'm going to do it. Will you help me make them as good as possible? And my answer was absolutely yes.
And then went on to buck another trend and release what turned out to be, I believe, still the best-selling foreign language record in the history of the American recording industry.
I know. Isn't that extraordinary? I'm still amazed every time I hear that it is apparently still true. And that was Canciones de mi Padre, of course, which are indeed, as the title would indicate, the songs she learned, you know, sitting on her father's knee as a child.
And as much as I love Linda Ronstadt's music, the documentary about her I thought was absolutely fabulous. But more than anything, I'm impressed. I don't know that anybody could handle her illness with the kind of grace that she has.
Correct. She's super smart. She's, you know, she's a science-based person. And, you know, I think she looks at it as, you know, as making the best of the situation that she's in and working, you know, with up-to-date science to make the best of it. You know, there's nothing good to be said about having Parkinson's at all, especially she's got this extra nasty kind. Supranuclear palsy, and it's an unpleasant disease, and she's indeed handling it with equanimity and style and you know, as I said, scientific knowledge. But it's no fun. But she's, you know, she's still in good spirits. She's in remarkable shape. I visit her as often as I possibly can. I haven't been there lately, of course, but I will. One of the first places I go, if not the first place I go, as soon as going anywhere makes sense, will be San Francisco to visit Linda.
We're talking with Peter Asher on Downtown. You've worked with so many big names, Ringo, Neil Diamond, Cher, Diana Ross, and yet you've got nothing but positives about all of them. And I guess people can be divas, but if they're working well with somebody, you find a way to make that relationship work. I saw a great.
It seems that way. I don't really get it because, you know, even Linda, some people say, oh, she can be difficult, but she wasn't difficult at all. She just, there were people who weren't listening to what she was saying, you know. Certainly, particularly back in that era, there was an awful lot of, you know, don't you worry your pretty little head about that, and we know best. And Linda doesn't respond well to that, or would not respond well to that. And Diana Ross, of course, when it heard scare stories about, you know, call me Miss Ross or any of that stuff. And in fact, now, don't get me wrong, I wouldn't want to not have done my homework. I wouldn't want to not know what I was doing. I wouldn't want to not be prepared. If I was working with Diana, but I never had a moment of anything but, you know, the greatest cooperation and the most astounding performances. I, you know, remember the first day, you know, I worked with Diana. We knew each other socially, but and I, you know, I was quite scared because you heard all this stuff about she can be really demanding, and she was charming and amazing, and I. What I remember above all else is none of that stuff ever came up. But what I do remember is the first time she goes out in the studio, you know, and sings the song on the mic with the track you've already done. And she starts singing, you kind of go, oh, my God. You know what? This sounds exactly like Diana Ross. All those Supremes records that you know by heart, suddenly there's the same incredible, super appealing, super soulful, extremely sexy voice. And you're hearing it on the big speakers in the studio, and she's singing it to you. And you do kind of go, life's not any better than this.
One of my favorite recent projects of yours is the wonderful work you did with Steve Martin and Edie Brickell on Love Has Come For You, as some of that which went on to become the Tony-nominated Broadway show Bright Star.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, I mean, that was a great project. And, you know, I've known Steve for a while. I was at dinner at his apartment in New York, and he played me. You know, what happened was he'd written these banjo tunes, and Edie had heard them and said, oh, I love these. Can I write a song to go with it? And, you know, and she didn't even just write lyrics to his banjo tune. She wrote a separate melody that fit on top of the banjo part and made it like a brilliant accompaniment. So, he played me some of the things Edie sent him. They were going back and forth by MP3s, even though they actually lived very close to each other at that point in Manhattan. And he played me some, and I went, these are extraordinary. You have to make a record. You know, Edie's such an incredible singer. And the songs they'd come up with between them were amazing. So I started to tell him about how I thought the record could be done. And I was actually on the plane home the following day, I think, or 2 days later, and got an email saying, you know, I've talked to Edie. Do you want to produce the record? And I went, yes, yes, yes. I specifically remember was my email response, and that's what happened.
Now, I would ask you what makes a great producer, but I'm sure you'd tell me working with great singers. So let me ask this instead: how important is that preparation to making the whole effort successful?
Extremely. When people ask me about that stuff, that very question, I emphasize that a lot. I think it's really important to make sure you've talked through everything, you and the artist are on the same page, that you know what you're trying to accomplish. You know, you've talked about the musicians in the, you know, or whatever, all the preparation that's necessary. Even this most simplest, but seemingly trivial bits of preparation. You know, the practical aspect of record producing is not to be dismissed, because you know, if you need to have some lyrics printed out, you know, make sure you've done that the night before. You know, if you need to get chord charts done for the musicians, do that and do it properly, because especially these days, you don't waste time. You know, that's if you're doing obviously a session with real musicians and so on. And even if you're just going to be sitting with someone at a laptop sketching out some parts in advance or whatever, you still want to have made sure you know which is the most likely best key for the artist, and how you're hearing the song in your head. And, you know, yes, I do a lot of preparation. And it really helps, particularly before you go in with the artists themselves to sing, or when you go in with, you know, expensive musicians where you have a limited amount of time to get a lot of things done. Preparation is key.
Does technology make the life of a producer easier?
Yes. Mostly yes, but it makes it much more flexible. In other words, there's so many different things you can do now in the studio, which is exciting, you know. But there are things we wished we could do back in the old days, you know, in terms of fixing things or changing things. But it also, of course, can make it more complicated because you're presented with so many different options.
Peter Asher, it is always wonderful to talk with you. Love listening to your show on SiriusXM Radio, From Me to You. And thank you so much for coming back and visiting with us again today.
Oh, thank you for having me. No, it's a pleasure. Your questions were brilliant, actually. You really, you know, you really know what you're talking about, if I may say so. And thank you very much.
All right. Well, having said that, then you have to come back again.
Of course I will.
Thank you so much, Peter. Be well.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye. Peter Asher with us on Downtown.